Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Mexican philosophy.
Where does it even start? Does it start with Spanish colonization, or do we include indigenous thought from prior to that period?
Long before Mexico was a country, philosophy was alive and well in the region.
What kinds of thinking do we do under colonialism and under the Baroque or golden era of Spanish colonization?
Liberalism, Catholicism, existentialism, all schools of Mexican philosophy.
Independence movements, what is it to create and form a new country, to begin to ask questions about how should you self-organize?
How can Mexican philosophy shed light on questions we face today?
You get up to the 20th century where there's an explosion of people trying to liberate themselves from the oppressive history of a bad version of liberalism as it unfolded.
What does the history of philosophy look like if you're standing in Mexico City rather than Munich?
These are the things, I think, that emerge in that kind of history.
Our guest is Manuel Vargas from UC San Diego.
Mexican philosophy.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. What's distinctive about Mexican philosophy?
How can it help us live better lives?
Does it speak with one voice or in a complicated harmony across the centuries?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Land.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KLW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about Mexican philosophy.
Oh yeah, Mexican philosophy. There's so many great ideas in there, Ray. Sor Juana's feminism, Emilio Aranga's existentialism, all that fascinating stuff from the Aztecs and Mayans.
Well, yeah, Josh, I like all that too, but why are we lumping all those things together? Do they really have anything significant in common other than coming from the same part of the world?
I don't get what your problem is, Ray. I mean, it seems like you're singling out Mexican philosophy, but we talk about Greek philosophy, German philosophy, and even, God help us, French philosophy. Why shouldn't we talk about Mexican philosophy?
Yeah, but when people say Greek philosophy or German philosophy, they're talking about one really specific set of conversations. They're really thinking about, like, certain discussions that took place in ancient Athens or, like, one kind of idealism from 19th century Prussia. But you're talking about a tradition that stretches over millennia and ranges all the way from ancient theology to postmodernism.
Okay, but it's still a tradition. Those voices are often in conversation with one another, and they've pretty much been neglected around here. It's time to get them back in the conversation.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Thinkers from that part of the world have made some really important contributions. Like in the 1500s, how Bartolomé de las Casas used Aristotle to critique the colonial practice of enslaving indigenous people.
Wait. Didn't Aristotle think that some people are natural slaves born to serve others? How could you possibly use that idea for liberation?
Well, Aristotle says that if people are rational, you can't just force them to do things. You gotta reason with them. And Las Casas argued that indigenous people in the Americas were rational. And Las Casas actually won the day. He got his colonial contemporaries thinking about ethics and the rights of native people.
Well, maybe, but he didn't stop them from, you know, killing them and stealing their land.
Well, yeah, he wrote about that too. His short account of the destruction of the Indies is this hard-hitting critique of the invasion and its brutality.
That's true, and that tradition of philosophizing about freedom just kept on going. In the early 19th century, for example, Miguel Hidalgo, leader of the War of Independence, used Enlightenment ideas to argue for Mexican autonomy.
Yeah, but how successful were they, really? And they didn't get separation of church and state written into their constitution, did they?
No, but the constitution did at least abolish the monarchy and protect the freedom of the press. And Mexico outlawed slavery shortly after that in 1829.
Yeah, that's true. And Mexican philosophers didn't stop there. In the 20th century, you had these Mexican existentialists, you know, people like Emilio Aranga, calling for an even more radical kind of freedom.
That's true. Aranga had that really cool theory about Mexicanness, right? He said Europeans, they're always criticizing Mexican thinkers for being full of resentment, melancholy, angst. But these things help us understand our fundamental existential predicament. And so make us more human. Europeans should be more like Mexicans, not the other way around.
Mexico also had a bunch of advocates for women's freedom, like the writer and poet Rosario Castellanos. One of her characters says, "It's not good enough to imitate others. It isn't even enough to discover who we are. We have to invent ourselves."
See what I mean, Ray? It really is one conversation stretching all the way across the centuries. It's a conversation about freedom.
Okay, Josh, but we just looked at a few examples. I bet Mexican philosophers have contributed a ton of other stuff to other philosophical conversations that we haven't even touched on yet.
Yeah, and I'm sure our guest will tell us all about them. It's Manuel Vargas, co-director of the Mexican Philosophy Lab at UC San Diego and author of the forthcoming book, Mexican Philosophy.
Manuel's also been teaching a hugely popular class on Latin American philosophy. It's a subject an increasing number of students are getting interested in.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out what Mexican philosophy means to students at a community college near the U.S. southern border. She files this report.
In the United States, philosophy is overwhelmingly white and male.
When you think of philosophy, you always think of the white European men. You don't really think of these brown kids from the border really having any sort of impact.
Manuela Gomez is one of the few women in philosophy and one of even fewer Mexican-American women in the field. She's a professor at El Paso Community College and the founder of the El Paso Philosophy Club.
I like to think that we create and participate in pragmatic projects that really have impact inside and outside of the classroom.
Many students at the college cross a bridge from Mexico to the U.S., and the club aims to show how philosophy exists outside an elitist academic bubble.
On one side, we have Ciudad Juarez being labeled one of the most dangerous cities in the world because of its drug war, because of its narco violence, femicides, etc. And then El Paso, Texas, as one of the safest.
The club is democratic, too. Members put ideas they want to talk about into a box, then choose at random. They research the topic and come prepared to discuss it. One time, they discussed the philosophy of traffic.
Because somebody got to the meeting late, and to justify them being late, they were just putting it in as a joke. And then it ended up being selected.
That turned into a discussion about the role of government in mobility and navigation, especially around the border.
And to us, it was a fascinating discussion because my students cross a physical bridge every day from Juarez to El Paso and vice versa. And sometimes it may take 3 hours to cross, sometimes it takes 5 minutes. And that's a reality to us. Like, the philosophy of traffic is something we never thought would be relevant.
At another meeting, they were reading Plato, talking about platonic love, and someone made a joke about not having a date on Valentine's Day.
And then the conversation led to, I mean, but do you really need a date? And is that really what Plato is talking about? And then we figured out, no. In fact, we're discovering that there's this more elevated and multidimensional type of love. And then from there, and this was the student's idea, why don't we all on Valentine's Day get together and have these random acts of kindness where we spread the love?
They talk about the philosophy of race and racism and moral responsibility. And in the last decade, they've raised over $40,000 in philanthropic projects. After the mass shooting at a Walmart in El Paso in 2019, members called an emergency meeting.
Where we talked about what does that mean to us? Like, how do we recover from this?
The club draws people outside the philosophy major too, like Jesus Guerrero, a former president of the club. He was finishing his bachelor's in biology with a chemistry minor when he joined.
Obviously, it was completely different from what I was used to from just hard sciences, and I just fell in love with the project and how much we were involved in the community. That's what motivated me to stay with the organization for so long.
Daniel Avitia, another former president, said the club has helped him realize how relevant philosophy can be to understanding his community.
Being a first-generation student here in the United States, my parents migrated to the U.S., and now living at the border, I see how migration is a topic that I specifically have like a personal relationship with, but also, you know, it's present in my community.
Borders are a big theme in the El Paso Philosophy Club. Geopolitical borders, borders in academia and in philosophy, and what it means to cross them. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about Mexican philosophy.
We're joined now by Manuel Vargas. He's the professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of a forthcoming book entitled Mexican Philosophy. Manuel, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be here.
So, Manuel, you've written about free will and responsibility. How did you first get interested in Mexican philosophy?
I don't really know, but I think I might have been born to it. So I got interested in it in grad school, and I like to tell myself that's how I got interested in Mexican philosophy. I was interested in whether or not there was philosophy that was done in Spanish. But a few years ago, I learned that this might be the wrong story about how I got interested in it. I was visiting my parents. They both worked as social workers when I was growing up, and I saw they had some books on a bookshelf that were on Mexican philosophy, and I pulled one off, and I asked my father, like, why do you have these books? How are these here? And he said, oh, well, when you were really young, I taught a community college course on Mexican philosophy. And this blew me away. I had no reason to expect that he had ever taught philosophy classes, much less on Mexican philosophy. And he showed me his syllabus, and it turned out I was teaching half the same things that he'd taught 40, 50 years before. So I don't know how I got into Mexican philosophy. I might have just been born to it.
Wow, chalk it up to like early childhood experience. So Manuel, Josh and I were arguing earlier about whether there's one thing that's called Mexican philosophy that includes all the stuff we're talking about, or whether we should think of it as multiple things. So who's right?
Well, on the one hand, you're both right. And on the other hand, you're both right.
Oh, good. I love being right.
But by this, what I mean is, I do think there is an interesting way of thinking about Mexican philosophy where it turns out that it's just any philosophy produced in Mexico, and we can be open about how crazy and diverse and disunified that is. I also think that there is a way of thinking about Mexican philosophy where a lot of it, maybe not all of it, is tied together by an interest in articulating what it is to pursue or achieve freedom, and what it is to pursue or achieve freedom under non-ideal circumstances.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's something that holds Mexican philosophy, at least much of it, together, right? As sort of contributing to a single kind of questioning. But what about what sets it apart? I mean, it seems like there's a division among Mexican philosophers as to whether it's better to think of it as having a certain kind of distinctness. We're doing something different. We're doing something special. Or in the case, I take it, of Samuel Ramos and other philosophers, well, no, we don't want to be thought of as distinct and special and therefore kind of separate. We want to be contributing to this global conversation about philosophy. Where are you on that?
So again, I think I like both of these views. That is, I think that there is something really valuable and important about particularity in philosophy and about starting conversations from where you find yourselves, the way the world looks, and trying to articulate and understand how a local picture of the world looks. And so for philosophers who've been interested in their location in Latin America or interested in the particular nature or construction of Mexican culture, I think that's a super interesting question, and there's lots of ideas to be mined from thinking about that particularity. It's also true, though, that as you begin to learn and articulate things about the nature of experience in a particular place and time, it turns out some of those ideas travel, and that's the way in which you can get universality out of particularity.
So I'm curious about this local concept as well, because we've been talking about a philosophical tradition that stretches back for multiple centuries. But Mexico as a country is only 2 centuries old. So what are we talking about? We talk about Mexico before there was this country called Mexico.
Yeah, this is a really great question, in part because the idea of Mexico itself is a contested question. When do we mark out Mexico? When does it come into existence? So formally, the country comes into existence in independence in the early 19th century. But at that moment, they're already describing themselves as a group of people that have existed for 300 years. So I'm inclined to a very capacious understanding of Mexicanness.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Mexican philosophy with Manuel Vargas from UC San Diego.
What can we learn today from 16th century debates about slavery? What unique insights do Mexican philosophers bring to feminism? How can Mayan and Aztec thought change the way we see the world?
Liberalism, Catholicism, and existentialism, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues. If we listen to Mexican philosophy, can we make life better than it was before? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Mexican philosophy with Manuel Vargas from UC San Diego.
Got questions about philosophy beyond our southern border? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and check out our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Manuel, we mentioned Mexican existentialism at the top of the show. Can you tell us what that was about?
What it was about was a philosophical movement that was designed to give us the possibility of the English language word mexistentialism.
Oh, that's a great word.
It's really the whole point of Mexican existentialism. But there was another point to Mexican existentialism as well, which was the idea that By the time the 20th century rolled around, what Mexicans began to experience was a kind of puzzling or question about who were they? What was Mexicanness? What did it consist in? There had been a revolution in the early 20th century that was supposed to liberate Mexico from its history, but it couldn't quite escape that history at the same time. There was a sense of being torn between the Americas and Europe and the effects of colonization. And so a group of philosophers began to undertake this question about how is it that we should go forward?
And Emilio Aranga writes a book called Analysis of Mexican Being.
That's right.
What is Mexican being, according to Aranga?
Well, it turns out Mexican being is accidental.
Wait, what does that mean?
Well, Aranga means it's an accident in two senses. One sense is just the idea that nobody intended to create Mexicans. There was never an idea about let's bring a new people into existence. So there's the fact of colonization that produced a new group of people who were not purely indigenous, but who were not purely European either, and who found themselves under conditions of being culturally influenced by both groups, but no clear sense of identity apart from the fact of being some kind of hybrid combination. So that's one sense of accidentality. It's a product of historical forces.
So it sounds like there's another sense as well.
Yeah. So the other idea of accident for Aranga is the idea that Mexicans couldn't take for granted a package of norms, meanings, and values about how to live. They were torn between these different kinds of cultural milieus, the Spanish and the indigenous. And so to be an accident for Aranga was partly to find oneself in a situation where you couldn't take for granted what it was that you ought to do with your life and how to live.
So there's a really interesting way in which the same set of ideas can sort of signify differently, land differently, function differently in different environments. So here we have this thing called existentialism that we often think of as, you know, being at home in Europe and in Scandinavia, in France, in Germany, and so on. Is Mexican existentialism basically the same thing as French existentialism, or do Mexican philosophers put a different twist on it? Does it do something in Mexico it can't do in Europe?
Yes. Part of what Mexican existentialists were really interested in is they were borrowing from and drawing from French and German versions of existentialism, but they were interested in how those questions applied in the very specific historical circumstances of Mexico. And in particular, part of what they were interested in is the idea that maybe it turns out that being unclear about what package of norms, meanings, and values you should take for granted revealed something deep and fundamental about the human condition, that something about the historical specificity of Mexico made a deep truth about human condition more visible, more readily accessible than it otherwise would be.
All right, so that's super interesting. How did sort of Mexicanness get to that point? So what was going on before Mexistentialism?
Well, the story really starts almost 500 years before. And that's at the moment of Spanish colonization. And I think the moment for some of those discussions gets going in what we think of as the Las Casas Sepúlveda debate, where European colonization is, for a brief moment in time, brought to a stop so that a group of philosophers could figure out the moral permissibility of conquest and what the basis was of people having rights or not underneath the possibility of colonial regimes.
Right. So it sounds like Las Casas was at least somewhat successful in getting Spain to reconsider what they were doing. Is that right?
So, yeah. So Las Casas' success was a mixed bag, but there were real tangible successes. So one feature of the success was that there was even a debate at all. I mean, one way to think about it is to think about the situation here in the United States right now. Imagine U.S. power getting sent somewhere else, and then imagining the United States deciding to pause on a military action because a group of philosophers are worried about whether or not it's morally permissible.
Yeah, I think the last time that has happened was Vietnam, and it wasn't really philosophers, and also the U.S. was losing.
Yeah, so this is one of the really striking things about this debate in 1550 to 1551 is that you have this moment where the empire pauses, and they pause precisely because of the efforts of Las Casas and some other folks, but primarily Las Casas, to raise the question about the morality of conduct and the status of the indigenous peoples. Were they rational? Did they have a right to self-organization? What was the most effective way to bring them around to the Spanish conception of the proper way of life?
And as I understand it, there were sort of two aspects to Bartolomé de las Casas' argument against Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda. So Sepúlveda basically said, look, you know, these folks, they don't really know what's best for them, right? So kind of paternalist Aristotle-type argument. We've got to make their decisions for them. They don't know what they're doing. There's all this human sacrifice. Clearly, they're not up to snuff. And we've got to get in there and take charge. And Laskasis is saying, they're fully rational beings. They're perfectly capable of making their own decisions. And so they have every right to make their own decisions. But also, even if you were right, Sepulveda, even if you were right, and you know, they weren't really up to scratch in that regard, it's not a good idea strategically, right? Make, preach, not war, right? So the way to win people's hearts and minds and convert them, in this case, to Christianity, isn't to force them to become Christian and adopt these new practices and values. Set a good example, you know, show them how cool it is to be Christian. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. It was a choice point between a coercive and a non-coercive way of trying to bring the indigenous peoples in the Americas over to the Spanish conception of what the good life was about.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Mexican philosophy with Manuel Vargas from UC San Diego. And Manuel, we have a question from Sarai in San Diego, which is, I think, relevant here. She asks, in what ways has Mexican philosophy influenced historical events in ways that we might take for granted today or be ignorant to? And she gives this example in the debate about whether enslavement of the indigenous was justifiable between Bartolomé de las Casas and Juan Guinés de Sepúlveda and others. We are aware that their works and ideas have had an effect on how enslaved Africans would then be seen as the primary imported labor force.
Yeah, so the good and the bad of philosophy is the arc of our successes and mistakes tend to be large, at least when they hit these kinds of world historical moments. And so I think one of the important things to recognize about Las Casas is that initially in his zeal for defending the indigenous peoples and their interests, or as Las Casas understood their interests, that he suggested that maybe one solution to the backbreaking labor that was being imposed on the indigenous peoples was to import African slaves, not his finest moment.
Now, Manuel, we've been talking the last few minutes about attitudes in what's currently called Mexico towards indigenous populations. But we should also think about indigenous populations speaking for themselves. So we have a question actually from Tim in Portland. He asks if you can explain a little bit about the Aztec or Mexica concept of Napantla and the Mayan concept of Inlaquech.
So the notion of Napantla is a super interesting idea, both in itself and over its history. So the idea shows up initially, it's a Nahuatl word for betweenness, but contemporary interpreters disagree about exactly how to understand that betweenness. So some people read it as a term that has to do with a kind of weaving in and out of. Some people think it's just being in an intermediate position.
So is there an example of where I might use this concept of Napantla or betweenness?
So a number of people have thought that Napantla was precisely the characterization of Mexicans or Mexican Americans in the United States, a group of people that find themselves between cultural frameworks, who are torn between finding Europeanness or finding indigeneity appealing or finding U.S. culture appealing and finding Mexican culture appealing.
And so this is Napantla. This is a term borrowed from Mexica, if I understand it, Mexica culture, what's sometimes called Aztec culture. What else is cool in there? What else is interesting? I mean, if I understand correctly, there's a supreme creator god who combines masculine and feminine principles. That seems pretty interesting. Sounds a little like some of the Gnostic gospels. There's a kind of philosopher king. That's kind of interesting. Philosopher king and poet, ruler of the city-state of Texcoco, interested in the impermanence of things.
Test question, can you pronounce his name?
I'm going to try. Nezahualcoyotl?
Nezahualcoyotl.
That was pretty close.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So tell us about the things that you find most interesting in Mexica culture.
So one of the things I think is super interesting in the Mexica worldview is the idea that as some scholars have put it, doing the right thing's got to hurt. The idea that you've got to sacrifice in order to contribute to the greater good, and not just contribute it to the greater good, but in some sense to keep the structures of reality going. It's a costly, effortful endeavor, and it's highly reciprocal, that we're all engaged in a process of having to forfeit time, energy, suffering on behalf of trying to keep the structures of the world intact.
That speaks to me, certainly. I want to ask another question from Sarai in San Diego, because I think this ties back to our earlier conversation about Napantla, which is what counts or identifies as Mexican philosophy. So considering the malleability of Mexican identity, how does Mexican philosophy follow suit with this challenge?
So Mexican philosophers have fought at various times vigorously about whether there is a Mexican philosophy, what the boundaries of it turn out to be. And there was a particular movement we talked very briefly about, the Mexican existentialist movement, that was precisely concerned with Mexicanness. But a different way of thinking about Mexican philosophy is to lean on the idea of any philosophy produced in Mexico, and then we can have fights about how to understand the borders of Mexico and which places and times.
But we can see some cases in which later Mexican philosophers are being inspired by earlier Mexican philosophers. So, as you said earlier, the kind of the legacy of the good part of Las Casas, not hopefully of the bad part, and also the legacy of indigenous thought. So people like Emilio Aranga again and Gloria Anzaldúa picking up on Napantla and bringing it into their philosophy. Do you see other cases like that of later philosophers picking up on the wisdom contained in Mayan or Mexica philosophy?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, so partly what you find is an attempt in the 20th century to take seriously the thought that maybe the indigenous people were, and this is, I know, shocking for some folks, capable of thought, abstract thought, and reasoning about how they ought to live together and what the nature of the world is. That's right. And so there's been a lot of really interesting efforts to try to recover that and to try to reconstruct it. Of course, we're challenged by the fact that one of the things that mattered immensely to the Spanish was to displace indigenous culture. And so lots of the works from pre-contact periods were burnt and were literally effortfully destroyed. And so what we have is oftentimes mediated by the work of early, what we sometimes now would think of as ethnographers trying to reconstruct that. But there are lots of the interesting and suggestive ideas in that time period about the reciprocity of suffering, about the world being unified by a kind of energy that transforms over time, that there's lots to talk about. But part of what I think is interesting in that tradition, in the wider, longer tradition, is that you have a conversation that reemerges as figures go back and try to reconsider the fights about how it is that one can articulate one's rationality to people who are in a position to have reason to not care about whether or not you're rational.
Yeah, so I want to ask about this idea that keeps coming up of, like, Mexican philosophy being a mixture of different things. So you've had some people like Jose Vasconcelos who think that Mexicanness is essentially about being a mixture of different things. Can you talk about that idea?
Yeah, so Vasconcelos is a early 20th century Mexican philosopher who also had a whole second life as a public intellectual and as a politician in Mexico. He's a kind of amazing, complicated figure. And he has this idea in his works in the mid-1920s about the essential imperative by Vasconcelos' lights to take seriously the idea of race mixing as a long-term solution to a distinct set of problems. One, human beings' inclination to draw borders around each other and to draw distinctions on the basis of race, but two, as partly a strategy for getting people to be open to the possibility of constructing a society that wasn't based on in-group, out-group differences about race or creed, but was instead about trying to create a beautiful world that we could all live together that takes as central kinds of commitments things like beauty, things like love, and the possibility of unification of people that doesn't turn on social identities.
Yeah, so how did other philosophers sort of take that up? Like, where did that go from the early 20th century?
Well, so one of the interesting things is Vasconcelos, when he was the Secretary of Education in Mexico, he just imposed parts of this picture on Mexican society. So as the Secretary of Education, he went out and started the Mexican muralist movement that had, amongst other things, figures like Diego Rivera and Orozco and various important figures in the history of art whose job it was to depict Mexico as a mixed race group of people. And then this theme gets picked up subsequently in the United States in the Chicano movement, where there was an effort to understand themselves as a group of people who realized the aspiration of the Vasconcelos project of race mixing and to get beyond the old racial divisions.
I'm really impressed by how much influence the philosophers we're discussing have had, not just on the way people think, but on things like which art gets funded or like what colonial projects the government is engaged in. It seems like Mexican philosophy has a history of like serious social engagement and kind of power.
That's right. So Mexican philosophy, as opposed to philosophy in the United States, and maybe philosophy across Latin America more generally, has a very long history of real serious important engagement. So at one point, Comtean positivism, for example, was the official state philosophy of the Mexican government.
Wow.
And you end up with these moments in which philosophers are wielding a tremendous amount of influence in political life and in the construction of important aspects of society.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Mexican philosophy with Manuel Vargas, co-director of the Mexican Philosophy Lab at UC San Diego.
Could Mexican philosophy help give us new perspectives on current events? Can it help us challenge colonialism and embrace our freedom? Will it enable us to lead better lives?
Freeing your mind in more ways than one. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Después de morir mi guerra, hoy renazco agradecida. Después de morir mi guerra, hoy renazco.
Music from Mexican singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade, as selected by our guest, Manuel Vargas from UC San Diego. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about Mexican philosophy.
Manuel, we've got a question from Luis in San Diego. Luis says, in my personal experience as a first-gen Latino college student, I've noticed a lot of Latino parents and families have a tendency to look down upon certain career paths. Did you always have full support when pursuing this career of yours? Not specifically as a professor, but more so in the field of Mexican philosophy. And also, ¿le va a las Chivas o a la América?
I'm going to start with the easy question first, which is the which football team do I root for in Liga Mexicana? So, the easy answer to this question is it's got to be Pumas. Anybody who's an academic and has interests in philosophy in Mexico, there's a pretty good chance that you're a Pumas fan.
So you reject the premise of the question.
That's right.
But what about the other part of the question?
Okay, so I was lucky. I was really lucky. When I came home and told my parents I was going to be a philosophy major, my mom didn't say anything negative, so that already made me very lucky. But then my father said, Mijo, that is fantastic. I can't imagine a better thing for you to be doing. Philosophy is the study of the human and the human condition. This is the most important thing you could be studying. So I just got super lucky. You know, there are a lot of folks who love philosophy and go home and tell their parents that they want to study these things and think about these things, and their parents immediately ask, yeah, but what are you going to do with that? And fortunately, my parents didn't seem to really care what I was going to do with my life.
I mean, it sounds like you had an advantage in having a dad who had taught Mexican philosophy.
Yeah, though he didn't say that at the time. I mean, so this was one of these things that it felt like I was doing something radical and new, and then as young folks are bound to find out, most of what we think we're doing that's radical and new turns out to have been something our parents did.
So Manuel, you know, I want to come back to the surprising degree of impact that Mexican philosophers have actually been able to have on their surrounding culture. If you had to pick one thing in Mexican philosophy that you think could have a really good impact on the way we live today, on the way we think today, what would that be?
So first, I want to reject the premise here. The thing I find surprising is that philosophy outside of Mexico has oftentimes not had more impact. And I think that's part of what's nice about reading Mexican philosophy and reading Latin American philosophy is that it suggests a different way or a different kind of impact philosophy can have. So that's the first thing I'd say. If I had to point to one thing that I would encourage everybody to go out and read, the answer is go read yourself some Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. Sor Juana was a 17th century nun in Mexico City, brilliant, kind of just gigantic, formidable intellect, maybe the most formidable intellect in a 150-year period in the Americas. A polymath, she wrote poetry, she wrote plays, she did all sorts of things. But part of what makes her work so interesting is she's a woman writing as a nun in the peripheries of a global empire. And she's trying to figure out what kinds of agency are available to people under non-ideal, that is to say, oppressive conditions. And she's really interested in what shape there is for these things, what possibility there is for culpability under these conditions. And I think Sor Juana is terrific on just these kinds of issues. And I think part of the reason why we should be reading figures like this is because these issues are very much alive today. And Sor Juana can point the way.
Yeah, so she was, as you mentioned, a nun. What role did Catholicism play in the kind of theorizing she was doing?
So Sor Juana was very much both a woman of her time and a woman out of her time. So she was heavily informed by and invested in Catholic thought and Catholic frameworks. There's disagreements among scholars about to what extent she was intellectually Catholic as opposed to spiritually committed to it, and especially towards the end of her life. But one of the things that I think is very clear for Sor Juana is that she draws on the tradition, but she also critiques the tradition internally. And this is part of what makes her so potent as a figure, is that she is very concerned to point out to the conservative Catholics of her day that there is an entire forgotten history of women's contributions, both in the church and out of the church, that point to the possibility of women being fully equal contributors in a way that was just not manifest in the time period.
And so how does that compare to feminist philosophy from Europe or North America? So, for example, Beauvoir, Wollstonecraft, Harriet Taylor Mill, Audre Lorde. Are there points of contact, points of difference?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be totally unfair because lots of people can have good ideas that they get to independently. But once you've read Sor Juana and then you go and read Wollstonecraft or Mill or even Beauvoir, it starts to feel like this is something that where Turnitin.com would flag them for having failed to acknowledge that they're plagiarizing the work of a Mexican nun. Now, of course, this is unfair because they weren't in fact plagiarizing, but Sor Juana is very striking in the way in which she anticipates a lot of later developments in feminist thought.
And she's getting there 200 years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I want to ask about this, like, responsibility. So her own choice situation is really interesting because you can see, like, being a nun offering her opportunities for reflection and, like, not having to cater to a husband that she wouldn't have had otherwise. What does she think that, like, women should do or can do to make better intellectual contributions to society?
So I think Sor Juana recognizes that she had a choice to make, and she was committed first and foremost to her intellectual life. And so that choice for her meant not being married, because as she's very upfront about and talks about in this one essay of hers, the choice to not get married was the choice to walk away from responsibilities to a spouse, to children, and so on, in the hopes of being able to maintain freedom for her intellectual life. Part of the challenge, though, that she thinks is that this is not a choice that is available to lots of women. And she's very sensitive to the fact that the structures and educational opportunities were basically closed off to women of her time. You couldn't go to school, you couldn't learn these things, and she was very lucky that she had access to a library and came to have the largest collection of books in Latin America at the time. And so she had these opportunities that other people didn't have, and she advocates on behalf of the need to have women scholars precisely so that there are more opportunities for women students to be able to study with women scholars. And so this is a thing that she identifies as a crucial possibility for one way that society could change to open up the possibility of a more equal intellectual freedom, and crucially, not to lose the contributions of women.
Yeah, and she has other views about education, which I think are interesting too. She thinks, you know, go broad, not deep. Learn about a lot of different things. I got to say, as you know, someone who came from the British educational system and loves the American higher ed system, I like that. I mean, not that we should never go deep, But the idea of what we now think of as liberal education. Can you tell us a little bit about more about Sor Juana's views about that?
Yeah, so Sor Juana had this picture of the world being organized, but being super complex. And that part of the thought is that if you learn some things over here and you learn some things over there, you begin to see patterns that don't emerge if you're studying something very narrowly. And she thinks that this interacts in a really important way with what happens when human beings screw things up by trying to gender the world. So part of what Sor Juana critiques, she's got this wonderful famous line that Aristotle would have written more if he had spent time in the kitchen. And part of what she means by this is that in a world partitioned by gender norms, where there are certain things that women are supposed to do and certain things that men are supposed to do, there is phenomena out there that have bearing on our best theories about the world that is just not going to get looked at by either gender because you're of the wrong sex or the wrong gender to be able to get access to those things structured in a world that was structured by that kind of category. And so this is part of Sor Juana's call for a broad education means not just study many different kinds of things, but a really genuinely broad education would be one that's not hemmed in by contingent or arbitrary, that is arbitrary with respect to understanding the way the world's put together, categories of social identity.
So this is also interesting because it suggests that she's got this view of gender where it's not just that like all of the good things are in the men's domain and women have a right to that stuff, but there's also a lot of valuable stuff in the women's domain that is just being overlooked.
That's right. Yeah. So Sor Juana thinks it's not just that women's domain is less interesting. Rather, she thinks, no, all the world is interesting. You can learn chemistry from cooking, and there are phenomena that you're going to learn in the kitchen or doing traditional women's work that is going to matter for our best theories about these kinds of things.
I think we got a lot to learn from that, and also from the fact that philosophy has been taught in high school in Mexico since the 19th century, and it became a constitutional right in 2019. I want to see that constitutional amendment here. But I want to ask you about a different strand of Mexican philosophy that maybe we could be inspired by today. I'm wondering about the philosophy of liberation from the 20th century. What in there is still of interest to us potentially today?
So I think there are two really important ideas in the philosophy of liberation. So one is that philosophy should be centrally concerned with the poor, the oppressed, and marginalized populations, and that it should be therefore be concerned for their liberation. And so I think the idea that we should be doing philosophy with an orientation towards who are the excluded, who are the marginalized, this is really important. A second thought that I find very important and instructive in this family of views is the idea that no social system is perfect. There's always going to be some residual, some leftover, some group of people who are not advantaged. And you always want to be trying to listen to those folks because they're identifying friction points in whatever the current social arrangement is.
So, Manuel, keep coming back to Luis's question about the value of philosophy. If there's like one thing about the social value of philosophy that we can learn from the history of Mexican philosophy, what should we take away?
So I think that one recurring lesson from thinking about philosophy in the Mexican circumstances is the liberating power of philosophy. That philosophy provides us with an opportunity to critique what is given to us and to see and fight our way to the possibility of a better world, or at any rate, a world that does less badly than the one that we've been given.
And what about the way in which the world looks from the point of view of Mexico City rather than Madrid or Munich? We're used to these histories of philosophy told from Madrid, Munich, London, Paris. What does the history of philosophy look like when told from Mexico?
It has a very different flavor. It's in conversation with the European tradition, but it's also its own history. It's like an alternative history of philosophy that as you run through that story, there's a natural question, for example, that begins with where does it even start? Does it start with Spanish colonization, or do we include indigenous thought from prior to that period? Then there are these questions about what kinds of thinking do we do under colonialism and under what sometimes is called the Baroque or golden era of Spanish colonization. But then there are independence movements. What is it to create and form a new country, to begin to ask questions about how should you self-organize and how do you deal with the fact of internal ethnic, racial, class diversity?
And then you get up to the 20th century where there's an explosion of people trying to liberate themselves from what they regarded as the oppressive history of a sort of a bad version of liberalism as it unfolded, and what kinds of intellectual freedoms that there are, and ways in which we can build new understandings of ourselves and new forms of self-organization. These are the things, I think, that emerge in that kind of history.
Manuel, I got to say, this has been such an eye-opening conversation. I'm deeply grateful to your dad for reading you these books as bedtime stories, apparently. But I'm also very, very grateful to you for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Manuel Vargas, professor of philosophy at UC San Diego, where he also co-directs the Mexican Philosophy Lab. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
I'm thinking, I wish American philosophers would take a page, especially from Mexican philosophers' ability to get philosophy taught in high schools and ability to get like multicultural art funded because it's a good thing for philosophical reasons.
Oh, the person can dream, right? And all that fascinating aesthetic theorizing in the 20th century. There's so much there. We're going to put links to everything we mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org. where you can also become a subscriber and dive into our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog.
Now a man so fast he's already been to Mexico and back. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, this may be Eurocentrism in action, but I can actually visualize certain countries through their famous brains. Jean-Paul Sartre sneering at the Eiffel Tower. Socrates throwing wine in the lukewarm thoughts of some Athenian poser. Back home, there's Noam Chomsky gathering splinters of good American wood to toss in the fire that will one day consume neoliberalism. And there's Jordan Peterson whining about vaccinations. No, oh, wait, he's Canadian? Wow, I had no idea. There's a certain amount of branding mixed in with philosophizing. Libertarianism and left-leaning government giveaways go hand in hand in America, and then they walk right off the cliff. Or a book deal might await at the bottom, the way treasure awaits in the Sierra Madre. I suspect Mexican philosophy is a lot like American philosophy, idealistic only with bandits. Of course, my feelings are covered by a couple of Robert Mitchum movies, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Ride the Pink Horse, Veracruz, The Long Goodbye, The Alamo, I suppose, and The Getaway, Mexico's where Steve McQueen and Ollie McGraw escape to, and of course, where the Wild Bunch go to die. Friends have gone to Mexico to swim, drink beer, and eat fresh fish tacos. That's my image of Mexico. It's either siestas and flan, or six guns in a village square, and in between. 100 years or so of revolutions have made Mexico a little weary of communism, I'll bet, but also capitalism. Even as drug cartels have supersized, Mexican politics has flair. Remember Subcomandante Marcos, the military leader for the Zapatista Army of National Liberation? He appeared in a mask like Zorro, or a Mexican wrestler on a winning streak. An activist and philosopher, he issued statements like, "All cultures forged by nations are corroded by the American way of life. Neoliberalism imposes the destruction of nations to reconstruct them according to a single model, a planetary war waged against humanity." Well, he's in his 60s now. Maybe time for a new subcommandante, like James Bond or Batman. At the heart of much Mexican thought, I've read, is a concept called Napantla, the middle way, taken from the Nahua's Florentine Codex. We travel along a mountain ridge while we live on Earth, an abyss yawning on either side. Only by keeping to the middle way does one walk on and live. Now, somebody told me once that if a Mexican bus driver gets in an accident, he runs away to a hidden village deep in the mountains known only to bus drivers because there is no insurance for bus drivers. So they vanish and live off their days only with each other for company. I met a guy from Mexico at another party who told me that story is absolutely true. Sure. Mexico has a long and varied history, with peasants and conquistadors and Indians and outlaws and rebels all commingling, war with the United States, war with Texas. Unrest got so bad, worried conservatives tried to install a monarchy. Maximilian, Austrian Archduke, became emperor, even though Juarez was already president of Mexico. Up north, we remembered the Monroe Doctrine, but it was a civil war, so we waited until 1865 to work an army at the border, but then Maximilian got captured by the president's forces and executed. Mexico felt bad about it. They kind of liked the guy, but they already had a president. Then the Great Revolution of 1910, Pancho Villa assassinated Zapata. As if in sympathy, Trotsky fled Russia to be assassinated in Mexico. The border has always been a problem. Some like it when Mexicans come over. They make our beds, mow the lawns, maybe build a house. Handy. Others, though, think Mexicans are just biding their time so that you can replace us. Mexico's pretty blasé about it all. It's like we're still Mexico up here. It just takes a little more effort to get here. There are a lot of drug dealers down south because Americans keep buying drugs. It's a free market in action. Now, speaking of market forces, it occurs to me that Alfonso Bedoya was a rare Mexican actor who played a Mexican bandit. Remember? The one who did not require any stinking badges? A question we all wrestle with. When are badges needed? Who issues them? Are there tests involved? Which is why so many turn to a life of crime, then try to make the border before the money runs out. Unless we're already south of the border, in which case, we hope we're Antonio Banderas in Desperado, and not Robert Mitchum out of the past. That one doesn't end well at all for anybody. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Oiga, señor, we are federales, you know, the mountain police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.